Omaha.
Monday, January 27th.
The broadcast is now starting. All attendees can now hear you.
Monday, January 27th, from Rack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday. This morning, you'll hear from Nancy Beckley, Ralph Webker, MD, David Glazer, J. Paul Spencer, Andrew Walkler, and our special guest, Leslie Page. Monitor Monday is brought to you today by Rack University. Now, here's your host, the publisher of Rack Monitor, Chuck Buck.
Thank you, Clark Anthony. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Monitor Monday. Today, we continue with our Navigating the 2014 Audit Landscape. Today's focus, the fallout over the two-year suspension of claims at the ALJ. And so that's where we begin this morning with Attorney David Glazer and our popular segment called Risky Business. David?
Good morning, Chuck. So I'll try to set the table here to make sure everyone's up to speed. So sometime in December, the Office of Medicare Hearings and Appeals sent a memo out to a select group of people that said, you've been chosen to receive this letter because you have a significant number of Medicare appeals currently pending before the Office of Medicare Hearings and Appeals. Now, personally, I didn't get that letter. We'll find out if Drew was lucky enough. But they went to a variety of people around the country, and it explained that they're going to temporarily suspend the process of assigning hearings to administrative law judges. The memo gives some history. Listeners know that in July, there was a temporary suspension of assignment. Well, that's now being extended. And the memo explains that the number of appeals is up significantly. In January of 2012, there were about 1,250 appeal requests per week. Last month, that number was up to 15,000, so over 10 times the number from a year ago. The average time right now to get a hearing is purportedly about 16 months, although I think Drew will confirm, and I can certainly say from experience, we're running longer than that. So the memo says that right now you can't expect general assignment to resume for 24 months, so it'll be 2 years before cases are assigned to an administrative law judge, and that the period after you get assigned to a judge before you have a hearing should be at least another 6 months. And this is a really significant issue, especially for big cases, because, as you know, once you've gotten past the QIC level, the government is allowed to recoup funds. And so they can recoup the money until you get a decision on the ALJ level. Just speaking from personal experience, none of the cases that we appealed in the year 2013 have been docketed yet. And I know we had a significant hearing in the first week in June for a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar case, and we don't have a decision on that yet. The judge made it quite clear in the hearing that he seemed like he was going to rule favorably, but we haven't heard a word. I think one of the issues we're going to be talking about here is what to do if you've got a significant number of big-dollar cases, because a small case, letting it go for 2 years isn't a big deal, but what if you have hundreds of thousands of dollars of cases there? And one of the themes we're going to be covering today is Drew is going to be attending a meeting in February, and he's going to be looking to gather information from you to take and present to the government. So I think our risky business for today is, what do you do when the government basically shuts down, Chuck?
Thank you very much, David. That was Attorney David Glazer. He is a shareholder at the law firm of Frederick & Myerson. Thanks very much, David. Coming up on the other side of the break, Nancy Beckley has all the latest hot topics and the Monitor Monday listener survey. We have much to report, so please stay with us. This is Monitor Monday. Stand by.
The Recovery Audit Program has reported almost $5 billion in recoveries from hospitals for billing errors. Most of the denials to date have been related to the chosen level of care, inpatient or observation. But the two-midnight rule changes everything. Now, admission decisions are time-based rather than severity-based. As a result, auditors will now focus their efforts on the medical necessity of the care, both inpatient and outpatient. Do you have a medical necessity review plan in place? Join us on Thursday, February 6th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern, when Ronald Hirsch, MD, will explain the concept of medical necessity and how it is interpreted in the current audit environment. To register to attend, simply click on the rotating ad on the Rack Monitor homepage or call toll-free 866-829-6612, extension 705.
Thank you, Clark Anthony. Coming up at 7 minutes after the hour is J. Paul Spencer with his update on the Medicaid racks. But now let's check in with Monitor Monday senior correspondent. That's Nancy Beckley. Nancy has all the latest hot topics and today's Monitor Monday listener survey. Nancy?
Good morning, Chuck. I'm going to ask our listeners to grab a pencil because I'm going to give a notation for that. First of all, glad to have Leslie Page with us today. Exchanged a couple of tweets with her organization at Proper Payments on Twitter last week when we were talking about this show. So it's great to have you on the show, Leslie. Now, from the in-bag today from the MACS, the critical access hospitals, we know they're going under the therapy caps effective January 1st. They'll be submitting their claims at the end of the month. CMS published MedLearn Matters article MM8426, that's MM8426, about how to apply the therapy caps to critical access hospitals. For our WPS, J5, MAC, and national providers, last week WPS held a critical access hospital audio conference unique to that particular MAC jurisdiction. So if you're in another MAC, it may not help you because they pointed out stuff on WPS, but it's a great resource, the WPS, J5, and National MAC. And we're going to pull up our poll here this morning. And what we're going to do, since it's very early in the year, we like to get a sense and test the sense throughout the year as to which RAC region that you're in. So please check number A, region A, if you're in region A, and you'll follow down to region A, B, C, and D. And we have an opening here if you are not a provider, you're not in a region, and you're just a friendly listener. Last week we found out when we tested who our listeners were that we had consultants, RACs, MACs, and other types of folks on the program. Chuck, we'll be back later in the program to see where our RAC listeners are in what region.
Thanks, Nancy, very much. That was Nancy Beckley. Nancy is president and CEO for Nancy Beckley & Associates. And at 10 minutes after the hour, we're going to check in with Ralph Webker, MD. But now let's switch to Washington, D.C. and catch up with Senior Monitor Monday correspondent J. Paul Spencer. Paul has the latest news on the Medicaid RACs. Paul?
Good morning, Chuck, and thank you very much. Well, as we know, we're now in the middle of the second year, actually the beginnings of the third year for the Medicaid RAC program. So far, as we've reviewed in the many broadcasts that I've attended here on RAC Monitor, we know that the Medicaid RACs have been concentrating mostly on things such as credit balances and assorted DRGs and some other issues for hospitals across the country. We're now getting indications based on what we're seeing early in 2014 that the Medicaid RACs are going to be expanding much further into the hospital environment. As an example, we have the state of North Carolina, where currently two of the bigger targets have been tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies, as well as ambulance services. Well, based on the plan of attack that's going on in North Carolina, it looks like we're going to see quite a bit more involving not only DRGs, but medical necessity of inpatient admissions versus outpatient services, which should sound familiar to each and every one of our listeners on the broadcast. In addition, I thought I'd bring to the attention something that may make Medicaid fraud investigations a little bit tougher for some of the states out there. One little-known provision in the PPACA was the fact that the ACA now requires that without actively re-enrolling, Medicaid beneficiaries are kept on unless they are found to have lost eligibility, their benefits will continue. Now, what this means is hopefully a little bit more stable of a population with regard to the way this particular population bounces between managed care and straight Medicaid. But what it will also mean is fewer controls and fewer ways to look at patient assets. So in that particular setting, fraud becomes a little bit more of a challenge. The ACA no longer requires an asset check. What it can do is it can check, they have ready access to data to check earnings, but not on bank accounts or other liquid assets. So what that means is that they're more than likely going to be the instances of possible fraud increasing exponentially, but the look is going to be on the provider side, which is a little bit unfortunate. I also wanted to add very quickly with the few seconds that I have left that I will also be attending the appellate forum at the OMHA in February here in my backyard, Washington, D.C. So I look forward to any questions that the listening audience may want to ask the ALJs and the OMHA office at that present time. And with that, I'll bring it back to Chuck.
Thanks, Paul, very much. That was J. Paul Spencer. He is the Director of Regulatory and Coding Compliance for Providence Hospital in Washington, D.C. He had the latest information on the Medicaid RACs. Very interesting, Paul. By the way, Paul, we are also going to be covering that hearing as well, or the appellate forum. We'll look forward to seeing you there as well. With important advice on how to rebill a claim under Part B when Part A has been denied for medical necessity is Ralph Webker, M.D. Good morning, Dr. Webker.
Good morning, Chuck. Thanks for having me back.
It's nice to have you here very much, Dr. Webker. So let's begin. A number of questions here. So the first one is, when can a hospital rebill a claim denied by a medical contractor?
So there's really been a significant increase in flexibility beginning with the interim rule and then really finalized with the final rule, the IPPS, and essentially for the claims prior to October 1st, if a claim was denied, you have 180 days from the time of that denial to rebill that claim. For the cases after October 1st, that flexibility has come in the shape of the ability to do a self-audit, and you don't need to necessarily wait for the denial. It's merely you can go back, audit perhaps the cases that you weren't able to review or you thought were particularly weak, but it's important to remember that those are subject to the one-year timely filing. The other thing not to forget about in all of this is that there's been a significant change or evolution in the impact to the beneficiary. Prior to the interim rule and the final rule, the beneficiary was always determined to be held harmless. And in the ability to rebill, because you're billing for Part B, there's going to be situations where perhaps the beneficiary may have increased financial responsibility. And this has been one of those items that I think has been pretty anxiety-provoking, both for the hospitals as well as the patients. And so having an approach, and especially a consistent approach on that, is going to be really important.
Dr. Webker, you had mentioned a couple of things here that caught my attention. One, what can an audit, or what can a hospital rebill claims as a result of a self-audit?
So you can rebill the claims up until 1 year as a product of the self-audit as part of the final rule. But I think one of the big take-homes is I kind of view it as a downward sloping mountain in that you can always take less money and you can always rebill, but if the goal is to get the appropriate amount of dollars for the services that you provided, you still want to get the correct documentation, the correct bill, the correct status as early in the hospital stay as you possibly can. So while you can capture some of the Part B services after discharge, there's some that you're not going to be able to. So don't let the ability to self-audit be a substitute for your real-time review, getting it correct as soon as possible, not to mention then the patient's going to be able to be aware of what the financial implications are for them as well.
Thanks. You had mentioned about the beneficiary. So in the event of a post-discharge rebilling, what happens to the beneficiary status, and what effect does that have on the beneficiary?
So the beneficiary, it has been determined that if there's essentially a change in that rebilling, they may have a higher responsibility because it switches from the Medicare Part A payment to the Medicare Part B payment. And where one of the particular confusing areas of the new IPPS talks about if you do switch over, they are expecting that you're going to balance bill the beneficiary for any additional dollars. And then to further make it more difficult, they're mandating that you have to refund the Part A payment by the patient and then issue them a bill for the Part B reimbursement. And in terms of whether this would be a violation of anti-kickback or attraction, they have essentially said that they're going to let the OIG opine on that at a later time. And so it's a particularly confusing area, but it's one that I think is going to start getting more and more press and attention from the different patient advocacy groups.
All right. Thanks very much, Dr. Webker. That was Ralph Webker, MD. He is the Chief Medical Officer for Executive Health Resources. And please stand by because we have a number of questions that are coming in on that very subject, and we'll address those during our roundtable. You know, as we continue our focus on the backlog at the ALJ, particularly the fallout from the recent announcement that the ALJ is suspending the review of appeals for 2 years, here now is Andrew Walkler. Mr. Walkler is a managing partner of Walkler & Associates. Good morning, Drew.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning.
I'm speaking briefly on the appellate forum again. I think this is a very important opportunity to galvanize both provider and beneficiary support to accomplish a fair and meaningful appeals process. Please send any thoughts you have to Chuck Bucket, his email, cbucket@recmonitor.com. We currently have a wait of 2 to 4 years with a statutory requirement of 90 days. So the law mandates 90 days. There's no easy fix because of the simple math of the volume that we have. And when we look at the stakeholders here, the RACs and CMS get their $5 billion to split. Omaha gets blamed for the delays, although they've got no additional resources. And providers take the brunt by funding these delays through the withhold process and through PPUR. It is important to remember that when we had this reform legislation initially, it was because we were having significant delays on both the Part B fair hearing side and the Part A Social Security Administration appeals. We actually had a case that took 8 years to get through the process. When we were done, the government paid our client $6 million, so it was worth the wait, but that's not the point. We need a prompt appeals process, and that was the legislative intent. So we have this forum, and the purpose of the forum as set forth in the Federal Register is to solicit input from the appellant community to help Omaha evaluate its policies and procedures to achieve meaningful backlog reduction strategies and process efficiencies while remaining compliant with applicable legal authorities. And the majority of the forum is going to be presentations by Omaha with an opportunity to input. Why is this happening now? I really believe that Omaha as an agency needs the support, needs additional resources, and this is an opportunity for hospitals and other providers to engage in political action, coalesce, and develop really an organization and galvanize support. Before this forum was set forth, about a week before, I spoke with Chief Administrative Law Judge Nancy Griswold, and I told her that I thought what was missing was a lack of consistency and input from the hospital community. And she thought said in response that there's going to be that opportunity, and it's coming up. So, you know, what are some of the solutions? It's not easy, but we have to push for them. One, I think there should be a committee, and it should stand from some basic principles. I think most of these are supported by the American Hospital Association. No withholds or prepayment review without acceptable, fair, and reasonable appeals process. Increase resources for Omaha. Legally enforce the current statute. If you miss your time frames from a day, you're out. They're not going to find good cause. But CMS can not comply with its guidelines. Alternative dispute resolutions. Expand the discussion period. Medicare cases do not have the ability to settle. Set a forum in which you can resolve these cases. Mediation, arbitration, or accelerate cases to federal court. More effectively consolidating cases, lower ADR, limits until this is caught up, and create a consistency of ruling among ALJs in terms of procedural matters. With that, Chuck, I'm out of time. Back to you.
Thanks, Drew, very much. I appreciate your soliciting those comments from our listeners. By the way, we are going to be covering that appellate forum on February the 12th. Thanks very much. You know, last week, the American Hospital Association, along with a coalition of recovery auditors, went on record opposing the decision to suspend appeals for 2 years. And here now, representing the Citizens Against Government Waste, is its Vice President, Leslie Page. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Chuck. Thanks so much for having me. I feel like a bit of a fish out of water here, but I'm ready to give you a little background on Citizens Against Government Waste.
Well, good. Let's start that. Let's talk about that, and particularly in relation to the ALJ. So we're ready.
And recovery auditing as well. I mean, you know, this has been very interesting for me to listen to all the folks that have been talking here, because it's all very technical and you guys are very much in the weeds. Citizens, in a good way, I mean that. Citizens Against Government Waste comes at this from the perspective of Medicare Trust Fund insolvency, government waste, improper payments, and just generally overall. We've been very supportive of recovery auditing since its inception in 2005 and 2008 during the demo project. So we've been very supportive of it. And in terms of the suspension of the administrative law judge appeals process for 2 years, which sounds quite long, we have not taken a position on it yet. We're looking at everybody's, what people are saying about it. Our concern is that the administrative law judge system at the moment, specifically related to RAC appeals or recovery auditing appeals, has been very, very inconsistent. And I mean, I would refer a lot of your listeners and your people who are listening into some of the IG reports that have come out about this, where they've talked about just different problems that the ALJs have had in adjudicating these appeals. You know, this is the third level. By the time it gets there, there's going to be a lot more interpretation of rules rather than more of a rigorous application of Medicare rules to this. According to the IG, they also allow new evidence to be brought at the ALJ level, evidence that may not have occurred or been present in either of the two earlier levels. They don't have a lot. They have they take on these cases on a rotating basis, so they don't necessarily cover the same Part A, Part B, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Each ALJ doesn't have a specialty, whereas I think the lower levels, they do have medical directors and clinicians who are supposed to look at these appeals in a consistent way based on what they know about Part A. And I understand also that CMS hasn't also defended itself in that position. They're not as often in front of an ALJ defending a denial, for example, or on an appeal, and that has an effect as well. So, and there's also wide variations in how ALJs handle these cases, and so, you know, sometimes the overturn rates vary from 18% to 85% favorable to the person who's appealing. And that tells you there's a lot of variation in the way that people are interpreting the rules at the ALJ level. So, I mean, I understand that people want to throw more money at the problem, and I understand that. And as a government waste group, we're always a little bit leery of that. But based on the stuff that we've seen in terms of the problems with the ALJ system, my question, I think, to everyone is whether or not there shouldn't be some serious reforms addressed in terms of how we're going to go forward before we throw the money at it.
Very good. Thanks, Leslie, so much for being on the broadcast. We appreciate your being there. And by the way, just a point of clarification, Leslie is the Vice President of Citizens Against Government Waste. Thanks very much, Leslie. Nice to have you on the broadcast.
Thank you, Chuck. Okay.
Now, it's time for our virtual roundtable. Boy, did we get a lot of questions today, so I want to make sure everybody's here. David, are you there? Good, David?
Indeed, Chuck.
Okay, good. Dr. Webker, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. And Drew, are you available?
Yes, I am.
All right. So let's begin. Here's the first question. Comes from Dr. Hirsch, Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He says, beneficiary appeals get top priority. Can't hospitals just appeal on behalf of the beneficiary by having them sign the ALJ appeal letter?
Chuck, I wouldn't do that, because I think one of the biggest things in an appeal is credibility, and the last thing you want to do is get before an ALJ having appealed as if you're the beneficiary and you're really not. So I you could, but I personally wouldn't.
All right, very good. Thanks, David, for that comment. Robert has a question. He wants to know, this is for you, Dr. Webker. He says, does a Part B inpatient rebill have to be determined and approved by the UR committee?
No. So, I'm assuming he's making reference to condition code 44, and one of the requirements is to have the UR committee physician agree with the attending physician as part of condition code 44. And if you're going to do a post-discharge self-audit, no, that is not a requirement. But just keep in mind that if you have the ability to do condition code 44 rather than a self-audit, the majority of the time the condition code 44 is going to result in more dollars. So, again, you want to capture it as early as possible.
Thanks very much. Dr. Webker, some more questions, so please stay on the line.
Chuck, yeah. I do believe there is some requirement different than any self-audit. Take a look at the rules, whether it requires the review committee. It requires specific steps, and so at least those steps set forth in the rules should be followed.
All right. Good. Thanks for that clarification. Dr. Webker, this is from Cindy Hart. Cindy wants to know, can you please repeat the information about timely filing when submitting the Part B claim after Part A has been denied? Does the filing timetable change in this situation?
Yes. So your main cutoff is prior to October 1st or after October 1st. And the reason that that's such a big timeline is because that's when the 2014 IPPS rule went into effect. And if you're talking about prior to October 1st, the ability to rebill is the claim must have been denied at some level. And then you have 180 days from the time that that case was denied. Whereas after October 1st, you have the ability to do a self-audit. So you don't need to wait for a denial or a review to occur. You can just go in and rebill that claim. For cases after October 1st, you're subject to the one-year timely filing. So if you're going to take advantage of post-discharge self-audit, you want to make sure that you do it timely, because remember, the contractors have several years in order to do a review. And so if you get a review at 18 months and that case gets denied, you've lost your ability to go back and rebill. So prior to October 1st, you must have a denial. After October 1st, you can rebill any claim that you want.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Wecker, more questions coming in. And by the way, we did not have our poll results reviewed today simply because of the large volume of questions that come in. We'll address that next Monday on the broadcast. All due respect to Nancy and her poll. Here's another question. This is from Stacy. This is for you, Drew. The question is, how will the suspension of the ALJ affect filing for Part B payment?
I think it's the same whether it's Part A. Filing for Part B payment, it doesn't affect it unless you actually have the right to go to the ALJ and the Medicare Appeals Council. So those hearings will be delayed, which means if you go back to the beneficiary and you file for Part B payment and you seek copayment from the beneficiary, it's going to be that much further away and that much harder to explain to the beneficiary. But the real key for Part B payment is getting the contractors to be able to effectuate it promptly.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, Chuck.
This is
Ralph again. One point along that line that I'd just like to throw out to the group is that 2-year delay in scheduling, I think hospitals are going to need to go back and really do a reanalysis of essentially the time value of money and essentially how long do you want to wait for that case to clear the appeals process. And up until recently, at least the facilities that I've worked with, the number of facilities that have pulled cases out of the appeals process has been relatively low. And if you haven't done this, it might be worthwhile to take a closer look and essentially say, what are the cases that you're going to lose? Because it would be a crying shame if you waited 2 years plus, lose a case, and because you should be able to pick out poor documentation, weak clinical facts, and different things like that. And so, I think that this scheduling is going to really beg people to go back and really do a reanalysis of what are the cases that they have in the appeals process.
That's got to be the final word. Thank you, panelists, very much for participating in today's Monitor Monday. Special thanks to David Glazer, Nancy Beckley, Dr. Ralph Wepker, whom you just heard, J. Paul Spencer, Andrew Wachlin, our special guest, Leslie Page. We have two program notes. One, Aaron Bliss from the OIG is going to be on Monday the 3rd, and we're going to be covering Nancy Griswold, the ALJ Chief Justice, is going to be on our program on February 10th. Thanks very much. Go out and make it a great week, everybody.